Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be talking about a fascinating book titled The Illuminated Window, Stories Across Time, published by Reaction, which is quite a unique journey, really, through stained glass installations that spans both place and time, telling us about diverse differences in technique, in style, in different places. And I certainly was surprised by the time range of the book, amongst many other things. So I'm very pleased to welcome the author of the book, Dr. Virginia Chieffo-Regan, to tell us all about Illuminated Windows. Virginia, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Miranda. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Nothing makes me happier than talking about stained glass. Okay.
Wonderful. So can we start off hearing a bit about you and why you wanted to write this book?
Well, I really need to go back to childhood, quite honestly. I have always loved art since childhood. Making, doing things and everything. And I was, I'm one of eight children, eight siblings with wonderful working class parents. My dad was a steam fitter and a union man, but they took us to museums and libraries. Hey, they were free. So that meant the government had them for us. So I just continued reading and looking and thinking and, you know, little by little, there you are through grad school and all this kind of stuff. But basically, stained glass is a public art, which means anybody can see it. And it was never made so that someone could possess it and pass it on to someone else. It was always made for a specific purpose and almost always for a specific place. So that it basically meant it's the stuff you bump into, and I got to really love it.
Fair enough. It's pretty cool. Certainly, I was fascinated and intrigued to read this book. But I do admit I came in very much with one question on my mind, and it is the first question I have to ask you. There's a lot of stained glass out there. How did you possibly choose which places and examples to include in the book?
Oh, well, how interesting that you phrased it this way. This is exactly the phrasing that my optics engineer, eldest son, came back to me when I said, Reaction Books was talking to me. She said, oh, no, give it up, Mom. You'll never do it. What? You will never focus on 12 objects. You will never. So I said, oh, watch me. I'm going to do it. And of course, then he, being the engineer that he was, wrote me a lovely little note talking about the mystical meaning of the number 12, how beautiful it was as a number. It could be divided in so wonderfully symbolic and symmetric parts. And then its importance to the Egyptians, the Babylonians, all the way on and on and on. So I thought, isn't that fine? Honestly, I picked 12 thinking, How can you bring across the complexity of this medium unless you dive deeply into a number of different installations that are different? Because then, of course, once you've looked at one, you know, huge cathedral, there are many, many similarities. There are many similarities in a parish church. So, but basically also, My cushion, or shall I say great support, is that I'm a member of the International Corpus Vitriarum, which is a Latin phrase meaning to assemble a body of knowledge. So that we have been meeting since 1949, not me actually, but since 1949, the institution has been in existence, and it was born after the ability that people had to study the glass close up because the windows had been taken out for protection during World War II to save it from destruction from the bombings. So now that organization looks at later glass. At that point, it was just basically medieval and Renaissance glass. Now we're looking at later. But we're in many different countries. And every 2 years, we have a colloquia extending over days to enable us to include important site visits. There are times they're scheduled where the windows are in restoration, so we have unparalleled opportunities to mount scaffolds, visit workshops, and discuss with all our colleagues. So that honestly enables this ability to then look at such a broad range. It basically is with the support of international colleagues. And honestly, that is the way all knowledge helps. All knowledge is grown. It's basically when you're relying on other colleagues. So that's basically enabled that breadth. And the Corpus Vitae arm has been over 100 publications now, very, very careful analyses of windows across Europe, including the Saint-Chapelle, telling you exactly what elements of the glass are absolutely authentic, shall we say, from the 13th century, which would be the Saint-Chapelle, and which have been replaced in the 16th century or the 19th century. So with that, one has, as Shakespearean scholars have, right, the authentic text. And you then can work with interpretations.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes a lot of sense. And it's always fascinating to hear about the communities and the conferences and colloquia and how they come together into things like these books. And of course, I'm not surprised that the examples you've just mentioned are the famous cathedrals, the famous religious houses, because that at least is very much where my mind went when I saw the book about illuminated windows. So sticking with that type or that, I guess, place for these kinds of windows, to what extent did these religious houses, as you said, kind of cathedrals are to some extent different, but there is a lot of similarity. Did they have kind of consistent themes in content and style across, for example, all the stained glass within a particularly massive cathedral, or what sorts of variations what might we see?
Oh, great that you asked that. They certainly change with time. All art, all society, which I think we sort of forget today, changes. It never stays the same. There are internal shifts, and there are then also external shifts, so that you have certainly a monastery at one point, for example, the Cistercians, we didn't discuss that, they did not want to have figural windows. They didn't want to have pictures. So they had what we call abstract designs in using a grisaille, that is a glass that had is not blown with any color, but then a little bit of color within a design might be added, but not pictures. And then that changed radically in the Renaissance, and they had many, many pictures. So that monasteries often had extensive use of this grisaille also to enable reading, because they were constantly used by a group of people who were out in there routinely, many times during the day, and needed to look at prayers and to sing and to respond. Parish churches also depend a great deal on the local people giving. So that, yes, they did change, but there is no one really a rigid sort of rule, you know, which I think is wonderful. Right. Yes.
Yeah. And I certainly was a bit surprised by that, because, of course, the popular conception is sort of everything is rigid, everything is told in a particular way. So it was quite fun to see some of the differences through the examples in the book, some of which, as you said, were different funding. Obviously, there's the replacement aspect if things get damaged. But you also document in the book artistic shifts in stained glass windows throughout time. So can you introduce us to some of the more significant changes in this aspect?
Well, I think I sort of need to look at, you know, very quickly for your listeners, the overview that basically begin in the 12th century with Canterbury and speak of the martyr's tomb and the cathedral. And even though we are looking at, shall we say, vaguely similar. Vaguely. For the specialist, it would be vague. Probably not. It would look like the same. Medallion windows made in complex designs and pictures within those medallions that are abstract. That's what I mean, is that you do not have three-dimensional recession in space. You don't have any relationship. Something far away is the same size as something close up, just basically so you can tell the elements of the story. A great deal, one might say, like a good quality children's book. Absolutely recognizable subject matter and brilliantly colored so it'll capture the attention. But you have a series of windows for describing in easily recognizable means all of the great cures and miracles produced by Thomas Becket, you know, to people who prayed to him at his tomb. And you also have extremely complicated, I can tell you, daunting, even for the specialists, analysis of the relationship between Old and New Testament stories, which, of course, were created for the monks and were seen by the monks. Whereas the popular area was open space for pilgrims to come in. So you see always a very careful understanding about who is going to see the windows. The Saint-Chapelle is giving us propaganda for the monarch, absolutely, all along, constantly comparing the present to the past and the divine rule of kings. Cologne Cathedral actually goes from the 13th to the early 16th, to the mid-19th, and to the 21st centuries in its play of windows. And the very last ones are completely abstract. They are just sort of color fields. They are not imagery at all. We also end up with Frank Lloyd Wright, certainly, and the light screens, which are abstract designs in geometric shapes. And then the final chapter actually is dealing with abstraction today and the spirituality of abstraction that goes across many, many religious denominations, including Muslim. We have the Pink Mosque in Shiraz, Iran. And we have Juan Villagrau, who is the artist who gave us the windows for Sagrada Familia, up to wonderful people such as Kiki Smith, who designed windows for the Eldridge Street Synagogue in New York, and Romy Fischer from Germany. So it's a wonderful spread, and I can tell you I had a lot of fun doing it.
I can very much imagine. I'd love to pick up on something you mentioned earlier in that answer, the idea of different parts of a church or cathedral being used for different purposes, and also that relation you drew with children's picture books, which are meant to be enjoyable, but a lot of them are also meant to be educational for children. So continuing that analogy, what sorts of lessons were trying to be taught and to whom through some of these stained glass in religious settings?
Well, first of all, these windows are expensive. I mean, they're expensive today, and certainly in the Middle Ages, before you had the Industrial Revolution, the cost of producing glass and the iron work that was necessary to hold that glass was quite impressive, so that only an elite client was able to afford it. But they all felt it was necessary. And that's what is so exciting about this, is that this is disposable income, not spent on, you know, jet setting around the world or you know, fancy food or whatever. But this is disposable income that is invested in a an experience that is meant to be experienced by others. It's a communication. So people are quite serious about what subject matter is in there. They always felt that they were speaking eternal truths to the people. And so therefore, the histories of the saints, as well as stories from both the Hebrew Bible, then called the Old Testament, and the New Testament, the story of Christ and beyond, these were presented but mingled in different ways. Sometimes, quite honestly, they were esoteric, as I said, with the analysis of how does the Old Testament relate to the New Testament, but how did it prefigure, you know, the advent of the Christ. At other times, they were quite, one might say, dramatic, you know, huge figures of power meant to reassure everything's fine. We're praying for you. Don't worry. Then you also have sometimes the ability to present local stories, and often later in the Renaissance, when you have more of a readership, we have actually local stories, even in the vernacular, that are being represented in the windows. Mm.
Absolutely fascinating to see that variation. I'd love to ask you about one of the examples in the book, because I admit there were some things that you talked about in this instance that I was not exactly expecting to come up. So I'd love to ask you about the All Saints Parish Church in York and how we can see social status, piety, those bits I was expecting, but also gender roles and literacy, was a bit surprised by that, in the later medieval period, if we look at the windows of this church.
Oh, thanks a lot. All Saints, first, let me put it a plug for All Saints. It is a marvelous building. Fortunately, a very well preserved, despite the inevitable destruction that came from iconoclasts. So basically, the rood screen is new, but the effort is to look back very, very carefully, and the restoration was meant to bring the church into a worship space that would reflect the early 15th century. The windows, for the most part, happily, have survived. And so we can look and see that in the center, we're looking at Saint Anne, who was the mother of the Virgin Mary. And she is standing there, well-dressed, definitely. We have to have someone well-dressed if she's in church, right? And then she is teaching the Virgin Mary to read. And she's holding a book out, and she has a pointer. And if we look back with what Chaucer tells us about the nun's tale, there's the story about the little boy who is learning to read from his primer, his prayer book. So that we sometimes are very categorical about thinking that contemporary ideas about gender discrimination, which still exists today, of course, were identical with times in the past. And we also think, oh, well, literacy is so terribly important. Well, it depends. Frequently, we find that it is women in well-to-do families who were supposed to learn to read for the entertainment of other people. The men were busy in business or, you know, clashing about trying to be military and all of this. But women were supposed to keep the home sophisticated, well-running, well-maintained, you know, and that everyone was well-educated. So that women were some of the earliest people who engaged in popular reading, literacy. But that also did begin with having prayer books that were in Latin. and learning to read. And so here we have right in the middle, St. Anne, who at that time was considered to have had two additional husbands, and that children from those additional marriages then were cousins. And so there was something called the holy kinship surrounding Christ. Because again, in the early 15th century, economics was based on family wealth and family connections. Your businesses with, oh, I've got family here, I have family there, and all of this. And then later, and as well as the concept of guilds. So, yep, women's literacy is absolutely there. Plus two amazing windows connected to literacy. One of them, the Corporal Works of Mercy, instructing people to feed the hungry, give drink to the thirsty, clothe the naked, shelter the homeless, visit the sick, take care of the imprisoned, and bury the dead. But in this series, bury the dead is not there because it was considered more of a clerical obligation. So these are things, when someone looks at it, they basically see someone like themselves, a rather well-to-do person, well-dressed, again, parallel to the kind that Chaucer is describing, coming in each one of these circumstances, coming to a home where there is a bed and a man is lying in a bed. His very worried wife is on the opposite side of the bed, and the man is laying money on the bedspread. So we identify ourselves. We also see him visiting the prison, those in prison who are sitting there in stocks. So that it is meant definitely to instruct. And another one is called The Prick of Conscience, which is about the end of the world. And it is based on an English, you know, vernacular poem called The Prick of Conscience. And they're wild stories showing fishes rising from the sea to roar, fire falling from heaven, people hiding in their holes. So, and instead of being presented in medallions the way we're familiar with, right, from Chartres or the Saint-Chapelle when we move into, or Canterbury, here, the stories read left, right, you know, left, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, next level, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like a comic book. So it's very easy to follow. The church is wonderful. People are invited to come and see. And it certainly, if anyone who visits York, they should not, you know, leave without making sure that they have stopped and seen All Saints North Street.
I am very tempted, in fact, to go see it myself quite soon. So I will definitely take you up on that recommendation. But staying with the theme of people seeing themselves in stained glass, if we move over to Switzerland, how did the development and independence of Swiss cities and cantons influence stained glass?
Well, first, let me be very clear. Long live democracy. Okay. And we see in Switzerland a diversity of expression with small commissions, because the windows are individually commissioned and they're about 35 by 25 centimeters. And what is delightful is we can quote Voltaire, who in 1764, before the French Revolution, looked over to Switzerland and said, "Happy Helvetia, to what charter do you owe your liberty?" The answer, "To your courage, to your resolution, to your mountains." "But I am your emperor." "But I do not want you any longer." "But your fathers were my father's slaves." "It is that for that very reason that their children do not wish to serve you." So it's this charming sort of, you know, French view of, you know, common sense, right? Here are people on their own and they do not need an emperor telling them what to do. And the Swiss did become independent, and is in many ways the geography really helped to prevent overrunning. But because of this evolution of art to be an expression of the individual and the home, you have many, many of these windows showing husband and wife with both their family devices. We call them coats of arms. They were not hereditary coats of arms in the same way that we're thinking of the nobility. And one in particular, a drawing we have, is illustrated that instead of the barred helm and the crest that is in the heraldry for nobility, we have a beehive, which of course looks a little bit like, you know, the curve of a helm. So the beehive, of course, is for industry, for hard work. And they become symbols of domestic industry. And on top of that beehive, over the husband's coat of arms, is a man, you know, half-length man, and he's carrying a flail for threshing grain. And she, on the opposite, his opposite, of course, is the female, half-length, and she carries a distaff. So it's this wonderful good humor, you know, turn on the, hey, come on, get off it. You know, do we need to have crested helms all the time? When have you put on a suit of armor recently, right? Okay. So that is the kind of good humor. And there was, I also illustrate another, which is this a family window, again, small. And it was given by Hans Jakob Baer and Elisabeth Frickner. So Baer is indeed like the word Baron, bear. So the donor, and I'm sure this must have been the donor. I cannot think that the artist would come up with this with such a that something could be misread. At any rate, they had 8 children who were all included in the inscription, so that we know that there were 7 boys and 1 girl whose name was Adelheid. So at the top of the window, where you sometimes just have, you know, people in the street and number of people, we have 8 bears, little chubby bears, all standing on their hind legs, wearing belts and hats and their Swiss, you know, their dolk, their Swiss dagger. And one of them has teeny little breasts, so we know that that's got to be Adelheid. And the story is basically that Elisha was taunted by boys. This is from the Book of Kings. He was taunted by very unruly little boys, and they were yelling and saying, "You're an old baldy." And what happens is that the bad, naughty boys were mauled by 2 bears coming out of the woods. So that picture is in the middle, and guess how many bears, how many boys are there? 7. So I'm absolutely convinced that this was put together, you know, for a town hall or for a inn or even possibly for the, what would have been a guild hall. Mm-hmm. And he was sure, you know, Hans Jakob wanted to make sure when people went by, they weren't going to forget his. And he achieved it.
No, that's an absolutely great story. Thank you for sharing it with us. I'd love to ask you about something else in the book that I admit I was surprised by and then almost annoyed at myself for being surprised at it. Because as soon as you said it in the book, as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, of course these things have some interaction. But I admit in my head, stained glass was sort of old tech and the printing press in my head was sort of new tech, and I hadn't really put them together. But thankfully, you have. So can you tell us a bit about how the rise of the printing press impacted stained glass?
Well, absolutely. The printing press impacted everything. Suddenly, it was possible to have an image, especially for the image, to have images exactly duplicated and widely distributed all over. International boundaries meant nothing anymore. It was possible, the sophisticated subject matter in these books and prints, which included classical literature and allegories, all became something that was far more widely disseminated. And remember that the Dutch, we're talking about lowlands and it's kind of hard, so we can use the up-to-date word we're using today, which would be the Dutch. They became very prominent as merchants. So they adopted a Protestant religion, which downplayed the image in religious context, but, shall we say, in, you know, en revanche, as we say in French, right, that the image in secular context became more important. And municipal buildings, law courts, guild halls, private homes, all were vying to have windows. And stained glass is actually a strange English term, because it isn't really stained. Okay, the Germans say, you know, it's pictures, you know, painting, Glasmalerei. So it's basically painting on glass. So that these roundels, that's the term we're using them for. The image was frequently painted on something about as large as maybe a good dinner plate. But they were meant to be seen in a series. So you could have a series of the prodigal son, and you could have a series of, Jonah, you know, the story of Jonah, or the story of Christ, or any one of these stories. But what they also did is that they looked to, again, contemporary literature, and delighted, of course, in demonstrating their sophistication by allegories of the seasons, virtues such as prudence, temperance, justice, and fortitude, classical gods and goddesses, and for the Dutch, especially, an image of Joseph. Why? Joseph was the prudent student, the prudent steward of Egypt. And so therefore, Joseph's being cast off, but then demonstrating through his skills and his management how he could save Egypt from the disaster of a famine, but also that then Egypt would become the breadbasket that would sell to the rest of the Middle East. That demonstrates that God supports good management. So without being idolatrous or anything like that. And we see these stories being told in these pieces of glass. Again, we call them roundels, that are a single piece of glass, and invariably they're painted with a neutral color. They look basically like prints, but of course, in my biased point of view, even nicer, because they also catch something that is used, that began to be used since, so around, let's say, the 14th century, easily. A technique of silver stain, which is a way of taking a silver nitrate and using it so that it would tint the glass permanently. And that was used then to highlight architecture, or a woman's, let's say, fair hair. If she had yellow hair, then her face would be on the glass, but then her hair would be yellow. And that technique had been used in the East, in the Near East, Middle East, decorating lamps for sanctuaries in Muslim architecture. So that then that got translated over to the Europe through Spain, and then became absolutely important. And so these lovely images that are all sort of, you know, shimmering in terms of the light coming through and illuminating these pictures, they then are enhanced by this gold shimmer, yellow. So they are absolutely lovely. And as you say, they were also, these kinds of stories were parts of furniture, such as a high chest given as a dowry. They had the same subject matter. And you could, because they did not have that solid color, they did not diminish any of the light that you wanted to have coming into a courtroom or a home, and not enabling people to see the paintings on the wall or the intricate carving on the mantelpiece.
Hmm. Yeah, no, those are definitely some key developments there. Before we move to perhaps some more modern examples, is there anything further we want to say about the development of roundels as well?
Let me think. The roundels are very much, if I haven't said this before, connected to the print. So, in fact, at an early stage, printmakers, you have the, someone usually paints something, and then the print is taken after that painting. And then, of course, you have to have a glass painter, which is a very different kind of a skill than for somebody who is etching a copper plate. A glass painter able to handle that. So that you have, early on, there was a development of associations between painters and printmakers and stained glass makers, which also tells of a sophisticated world. And it also, I guess this is the time I should basically say something that maybe has been implicit all throughout. But what is thrilling about this is to see cooperation. Certainly, of course, artists were, oh, but I can do this better than someone else. It happens all the time. Whenever we're doing something, we say, pick me. I really do it well. I mean, why shouldn't we? But the idea that somehow a work of art is produced by somebody meditating in a closet, and then a great burst of personal, genius, and then a construction, and that the recipient is there saying, oh, I'm so happy you have told me all about this. That's not the way art worked. There was always a relationship between the client, certainly, especially for stained glass. Well, and printmaking in the same way. You're not going to go through the immense expense of engraving a plate unless you know that somehow you're going to sell it to somebody. And you are certainly not going to construct a window unless you know what building it's going to go into. So that there is this relationship. And from my standpoint, you know, an excitement about the ability of the artist to see the sense of the patron. That if an artist doesn't know that they are going to be really appreciated by a discriminating patron, it's hard to get up that enthusiasm to put in that, you know, 120%, right? But when you know there's somebody out there whose discriminating taste has already, you know, achieved this, this, and this, you're going to say, I'm going to be on that same level. One, I know this is a painting. This is Michelangelo. Why do you think that Sistine ceiling was that good? He was competing against Botticelli down below, right? He came into a place and said, oh, all of these paintings on the lower level are looking like tapestries. They're meant to look like tapestries. I'm going to do something that looks like sculpture. So, yeah, it is. It, so, and it's us to see that we get the art that we support.
So, in fact, my penultimate question is about kind of in some ways similar to what you've just told us about the Sistine Chapel, the mingling of styles. Taking us to a more modern example, in fact, one that, again, people can, I believe, still see, is the various different illuminated glass on show at Harvard University that you document is very much a mingling of artistic styles, a mingling of different references. Can you talk us through what's significant about this?
Well, fortunately, the records are still kept in the university archives. So, and they're in English. Isn't that lovely?
And modern English, too.
And modern English, yes. They're in modern English. So really, amazingly easy to look at. The windows from the very beginning were meant to be gifts of the graduating classes. So the university built Memorial Hall, indeed, to commemorate the sacrifice of those who had died in the Civil War. And there were quite a few. It was a high number in relationship to those who set out and those who came back. So they wanted to have windows that reflect scholarship and service, and frequently military service, because that's what they saw. But they wanted to see it. They had said from a time before Shakespeare, and then there was some leeway for that. But each class had their own committee. And at that time, an elite economic status also demanded a sophistication in the arts. And that the artist knew that they were expected to work with the committee and the subject matter. And frequently, they were on exactly the same social level, or shall we say educational level, John Lafarge, who did two windows for the class. He was a good friend of many of the Harvard graduates and, you know, worked with them, wrote, traveled, counseled. So it was an elite tradition, but one based on broad learning. At that time, entrance into Harvard was proficiency in Greek and Roman, well, literacy. And the assumption, of course, if you can handle Greek and Roman well, then obviously everything else will follow. So you see, for example, a morning Athena. Oh, she's just absolutely wonderful. She's presented holding a memorial wreath. They're called a tenne. It's a memorial ribbon. And she's about to put this on a monument, which is, of course, absolutely classical tradition. You've got different kinds of people. For example, Sarah Wyman Whitman designed a window in honor of the first director of the Museum of Fine Arts, Martin Brimmer. And the window has Sir Philip Sidney in it, of course, giving the tradition of his death caused by his wounds at the Battle of Zutphen, and also St. Martin, because Brimmer traced his heritage back to French Huguenot roots. So you've got people who are commissioning the artists, but also artists who are deeply aware of the demands, or shall we say, the reception of their work. So, and they were actually also asked not only to create a subject matter, but that the decorative frame of the window was to evoke the decorative patterns from the period of time that was being represented. So if you had Virgil and Homer, you had classical motifs, acanthus leaves, Greek keys. And if you were going to have something from Shakespeare, well, obviously it was in a Renaissance mode. So it was, but it definitely shows that it is that synergism between someone commissioning and someone executing that is just gives us then a statement of the past speaking to the future.
No, absolutely. Well, there's obviously so much more I could ask you about and so many more examples of illuminated windows that I'm sure you could have included in the book. But I think we'll leave it here with a sort of highlights tour of the book itself.
Oh,
with,
great, great.
Of course, more to, there's so much more to explore, I'm sure. So I only have a final question. What are you exploring next? Is there anything you might be working on, whether or not it's about illuminated windows, that you'd like to share with us?
Well, the delight is I'm working with the fabulous Swiss.
Mm.
Yes, I am. The Swiss International Corpus Vitriorum, their committee, has an online database called VitroSearch. VitroSearch. So V-I-T-R-O, and then the English word search, S-E-A-R-C-H. Mm-hmm. And it's interconnected, and you can search for subject matter, you know. And so what I'm doing, simply because I've researched a Swiss glass in the United States for several publications, one of them coming out right now that is profiling the glass at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art and the glass at the Getty Museum. Previously, I did a publication of Central U.S. that with the work in Chicago and Michigan and a number of other museums. So I had been looking at the Swiss, and happily, a great deal of it is around here. Princeton University has a wonderful collection. The Morgan, the J.P. Morgan Library and Museum has a wonderful collection. Harvard University and their Divinity School has a great collection. I'm not talking huge. We're talking about maybe 10, 15, 20. But ultimately, there are about 200 panels in the U.S. And so it is now possible to research and get them over to my fabulous Swiss colleagues, and they will then set them up on their database so that they are instantly available to everyone. So it's a very exciting thing.
Yes, very cool. Thank you for sharing that with us. And it very much speaks to the book we've been discussing. Again, for anyone who now wants to go read all about this, the book is titled The Illuminated Window, Stories Across Times, published by Reaction. Virginia, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
It has been wonderful. I'm very, very grateful that you asked me, and good luck with all of your interviews.